Well, the modern philosophers, the Rolling Stones, capture well the frustration and angst of our passage today when they say, I can't get no satisfaction. I can't get no satisfaction. And I try, and I try, and I try, and I try, but I can't get no. I can't get no. That's our passage today. In a way, it is. So notice in the ESV, in our text 5:8 to 6:12, you'll see three times the word satisfy is used, but then you have other words like enjoy, enjoyment, and rest. Where are we going to go? So satisfaction, how do we find it? That enjoyment and rest in life. And of course, that other philosopher, Peter Kreeft, recall what he said, that Ecclesiastes gives us the question that we need the rest of the Bible to provide the answer for. We know more than the preacher. So the preacher describes the brutal realism of life under the sun. He doesn't pull any punches. He lays it out for us. He gives us the dark silhouette that shows the shape of what we need. And I believe he's en route to this. He's not there yet, but he's repenting Solomon, is how I view it. Traditionally, that's how preachers and theologians have viewed it. He's on the way, and he's working that direction. It gives us the shape of who we need, a dark silhouette. And this is really probably the darkest section in the preacher Solomon's sermon. Philip Ryken would say chapter 6 is one of the darkest chapters in the whole Bible. Yet, thankfully, the preacher points to hope. He gives us signs towards hope in the midst of darkness. He shows us little glimmers of who we need to fill the void, where we can find satisfaction, enjoyment, and rest. Nevertheless, again, his sermon is incomplete. We need the whole story. We need the full unveiling of the gospel to understand the whole answer. Well, last week, if you remember, we went to church. Talked about worshiping wisely, not foolishly. And so now you get the idea in our chapter. And isn't that the way it is? The darkest chapter is following our worship service. They went to the mountaintop, and now they went down to the pit. I don't know if that's ever happened to you. They worshiped God. He sought to worship God in the fear of the Lord, wisely, not foolishly. Then he walked out the front doors of the church. He entered into the world again, and all the pressures caved in on him. What does worship have to do with the workaday world? You get back into the world, you observe under the sun, you experience under the sun, you feel the tug, and what you get caught up in is not the fear of the Lord, but the fear of money. And everything that goes along with that, the pursuit of money. And that's the unifying theme, really, in this section. It's money. The question is, are we going to look for satisfaction in money? So a TED Talk back in 2015 entitled, What Makes a Good Life? Lessons from the Longest Study in Happiness, which is really an incredible study. It's like 75 years, led by Harvard. They asked millennials what their most important life goals were, and 80% of them said, well, to get rich. And it's no surprise. You remember Tim Keller in his Idols book, he's commenting on greed as idolatry. And he says, money can take on divine attributes. And our relationship to it then approximates worship and abeyance. It's an uncanny ability money has to present itself as God because it purports to do for us what God does for us. That's not to say that the desire to get rich in itself is wrong. I hope Bible believers, Jesus-loving people get abundantly rich. The concern is, are we looking to money to satisfy us? All right, so the preacher, he knew a little bit about this. To disabuse us of this mindset, the preacher develops, I think, 9 reasons. Get ready. 9 reasons. Think of them as the 9 ring wraiths. 9 reasons why money can't satisfy us. And then the flip side is, you learn by contrast, it's the dark silhouette. You see what ought to satisfy us, and just think about it, through what we learn what can't satisfy us. All right, so Ecclesiastes 5, verse 8. Let's read. If you see in a province the oppression of the poor and the violation of justice and righteousness, do not be amazed at the matter. For the high official is watched by a higher, and there are yet higher ones over them. But this is gain for a land if in every way a king committed to cultivated fields. He who loves money will not be satisfied with money, nor he who loves wealth with his income. This is vanity. When goods increase, they increase who eat them. And what advantage has their owner but to see them with his eyes? Sweet is the sleep of a laborer, whether he eats little or much, but the full stomach of the rich will not let them sleep. There's a grievous evil that I've seen under the sun. Riches were kept by their owner to his hurt, and those riches were lost in a bad venture. And he is father of a son, but he has nothing in his hand. As he came from his mother's womb, he shall go again naked as he came and shall take nothing for his toil that he may carry away in his hand. This also is a grievous evil. Just as he came, so shall he go. And what gain is there to him who toils for the wind? Moreover, all his days he eats in darkness, in much vexation and sickness and anger. Behold, what I have seen to be good and fitting is to eat and drink and find enjoyment in all the toil with which one toils under the sun, the few days of his life that God has given him, for this is his lot. Everyone also to whom God has given wealth and possessions and power to enjoy them and to accept his lot and rejoice in his toil, this is the gift of God. For he will not much remember the days of his life because God keeps him occupied with joy in his heart. There is an evil that I've seen under the sun, and it lies heavy on mankind, a man to whom God gives wealth, possessions, and honor, so that he lacks nothing of all that he desires. Yet God does not give him power to enjoy them. But a stranger enjoys them. This is vanity. It is a grievous evil. If a man fathers 100 children and lives many years, so that the days of his years are many, but his soul is not satisfied with life's good things, and he also has no burial, I say that a stillborn child is better off than he. For it comes in vanity and goes in darkness, and in darkness its name is covered. Moreover, it has not seen the sun or known anything, yet it finds rest rather than he. Even though he should live 1,000 years twice over, yet enjoy no good, do not all go to one place? All the toil of man is for his mouth, yet his appetite is not satisfied. For what advantage has the wise man over the fool? And what does the poor man have who knows how to conduct himself before the living? Better is the sight of the eyes than the wandering of the appetite. This also is vanity and a striving after wind. Whatever has come to be has already been named. And it is known what man is, and that he is not able to dispute with one stronger than he. The more words, the more vanity, and what is the advantage to man? For who knows what is good for man while he lives the few days of his vain life, which he passes like a shadow? For who can tell man what will be after him under the sun? The grass withers and the flowers fade. That's pretty apparent. But the word of our God endures forever. Thanks be to God. Reason number one, why money is a bad master. The world under the sun is corrupt, verses 8 and 9. So the preacher says, when you see systemic oppression in the world, the trampling of justice and righteousness, don't be surprised. That's the kind of thing that goes on under the sun. It should anger and grieve you, but it shouldn't shock you. You should try to eliminate it, but it will always emerge. Fallen human nature will abuse power to its own advantage. And the preacher's mainly speaking about governmental malfeasance. And some governments are better than others. We're thankful for our checks and balances. Nevertheless, self-serving interests, coercion for gain, exploitation of the weak, they occur in our country. So the poor man's interests can get caught up and lost in bureaucratic red tape. That's the sense here. You got these different levels. The higher officials also pressure the lower officials. Maybe they're fleecing the lower officials. Maybe if you've ever been audited personally or in your business, you felt this, like, how am I going to deal with this engine? But even in business, it can be that way, and the bottom line can be much more significant than the person. So if you've ever been given the runaround by an insurance company, which can be baffling and worrying, you know, you think of Mr. Incredible when he's in his office and he's trying to sneak that right form to the right department to get your claim heard. You can feel that way. Well, there's something of that frustration here. And in all that, the poor, the lowest rung, they're getting the worst end of the stick. Well, verse 9 may be hopeful, because verse 9 talks about the king cultivating fields, but it can be translated different directions. So scholars, some take it negatively, some positively. If negatively, it's saying the king's implicit too, all the way up to the top. It's this system of coercion and oppression. But positively, and that's how the ESV translates it, I kind of prefer it. It's saying a good king can curb the tyranny in society if he devotes himself to cultivating his fields, what's most important. It helps everybody if he's concerned for that. So we ask, you know, what kind of king was Solomon? Well, he was both. He did both, obviously. He was tremendously wealthy. But he was imperfect, and that's realism under the sun. And really in this, you see the need for the true king. The Isaiah 9 king, that the government would be on his shoulders, that he would truly be the one who cultivates the fields. Number two, the second reason money is a bad master or can't be what satisfies us. Verse 10, no amount of money is going to be enough. It just won't be. You know your heart. And this is the most direct statement. He's saying money can't satisfy. The idea is when you hit your target, if you reach that goal, it's gonna move. The target's gonna shift. You're never gonna say, good, that's it, that's enough. It's like when the famous quote when the reporter asked John D. Rockefeller, you know, I mean, the first U.S. billionaire, at that point, the richest man in the world, how much money is enough? And very calmly, he looked at the reporter and said, just a little bit more. Somewhere I read a study on the full spectrum of the socioeconomic status. Rich and poor, they ask them, how much money do you need to be, you know, content? And whether they were at the lower end or the higher end, they all responded the same way. It ended up being about 25% more. It's always just going to be a little bit more. It's not going to satisfy. Third reason, verse 11, the more you make, the more bills you have. So Solomon knew a little bit about this. You remember in 1 Kings 4, the provisions he needed just to feed his court? They're astronomical, what he needed. What a burden on him. But we can sympathize. Some of y'all have talked to me about how, you know, when you're studying, maybe you got married when you're studying, you're so happy with almost nothing, but now there's so much stress on you. When we toured, Alan and I went, and our family went and toured Monticello, Thomas Jefferson's plantation, and we were shocked that they told us that essentially when he died, he was bankrupt. For all the expenses of running the plantation and then this status he was in to welcome dignitaries and officials and entertain them to a certain caliber, he was essentially bankrupt when he died. So we look at this, whether it's taxation, whether it's all the employees you have, whether it's hangers-on, whether it's maintaining your social standing, whether it's raising your tastes and expectations, more money tends to result in more bills. Fourth reason that money won't satisfy, the more you make, the less you sleep. Verse 12. And he may be saying that when you get wealthy, you get lazy or idle, and you eat richer food and get indigestion and then can't fall asleep. That may be it. He also could be saying that when you get wealthy, it means you have more authority and more people depend upon you and more is at stake and you get a stomach ulcer and you're stressed out all the time and your brain's spinning and you can't fall asleep. Which one hit? Either way, the preacher is wistfully thinking of a manual labor guy. He just wakes up. He gets his hoe, his shovel. He goes out in the field. He punches the clock. He works with his body and wears himself out and uses his muscles. He gets back home. He eats a simple dinner, sits around, and then he goes to sleep and sleeps like a rock. And he's going, that's where I want to be. Like, just let me work in the field. When it's all said and done, that's better. Five, money is terribly unstable, verse 13 to 16. So the preacher doesn't just give us principles, but then he also wants to convince us so much that money can't satisfy that he offers actually illustrations or stories or examples or case studies. So he tells about this man. And he just gave it. He was diligent. He was frugal. He worked hard. He plodded along. He saved. He built up gradually this wealth. But then he made some bad decision, or maybe things just went off the rails. He invested in a bad business deal. The venture went south, and in one fell swoop, he lost it all. All. I mean, maybe a hurricane hit, or maybe a flood rose from nowhere, maybe a fire spread all through the city, maybe the market crashed. There's so many things that could happen under the sun. And he's left with nothing. Everything he plodded along and toiled for, nothing. It vanished. It's over. And he's a dad with a son. The worst legacy. I mean, what you didn't want to do, he has nothing to leave for inheritance. He came in the world without anything. He's going without anything. Kidner, the commentator, says, money has spoiled his life twice over, first in the getting and then in the losing. Two times, the preacher says, it's a grievous evil. Money promises stability, and it just can't deliver. Six. Money can suck the life out of you. Verse 17. This is one of the darkest verses about all the days in darkness, vexation, sickness, and anger. It's related to what the illustration we just mentioned, but it looks like it's making a further point. This man's so committed and preoccupied, obsessed with money, that he ends up isolating himself in darkness, vexation, sickness, and anger. Money can engender these emotions. You know, it's a question we ask ourselves if I'm dealing with really low thoughts, depressive thoughts, anger thoughts. Is there some diagnosing that needs to take place? Might part of that be an over-desire for money and possessions? We keep 15, verse 15 in mind. We come naked into the world and go naked out of it. We can't take it with us. And that's hard for us to take. Like, we're not going to take it with us. It compounds the situation. It's why, you know, the shape of what we need, the silhouette, Jesus' words. That's why you don't lay up treasures here. You lay up treasures in glory, where moth and rust can't steal and corrode. Verse number seven. Seventh reason, we're going to jump down to chapter 6, verse 1. You may gain money and still not get to enjoy it. So the preacher gives another anecdote to drive his point home. He describes, now this is not a plotter, but this is like outstanding, gifted, exceptional person. And God gives this exceptional person who just skyrockets into wealth and notoriety. He gives him wealth, possessions, and honor, the things we all want. Like, he's got it. He's made it. He's the guy. And, you know, maybe Solomon's speaking autobiographically. First, 2 Chronicles 1 says he had possessions, wealth, and honor. So maybe he's kind of laying his heart out there for us. Yet though God grants him these gifts, God doesn't give this extraordinary person the additional gift. And so what's the additional gift? Well, the power to enjoy it. See, the opportunity and ability to enjoy the gifts is another distinct gift. One thing is the gift. One is the opportunity and ability to enjoy it. Philip Ryken says, satisfaction is sold separately. Or Derek Kidner again, the power to enjoy God's gifts may or may not be allotted to us. So really, it's a good prayer. I've been thinking this through in a way I haven't before. Father, help me to enjoy the gifts you've given me. So in this part of the illustration, the reason this exceptional guy can't enjoy the gift is that something happens. I mean, probably, he might be overrun, bad investment. Probably he dies before he gets the chance to enjoy the gifts. And so the point is, one thing is the gifts themselves, another is the power to enjoy them. But that leads us to the next anecdote, number 8. The 8th reason is you may gain all the best things and still not be satisfied with them. And that's verse 3 and 6, 2-6. So the anecdote continues, in order to press the point that the stuff is one gift, but the satisfaction of it is another, that the preacher extends it to gifts other than money to make sure that we know the principle applies to everything, all the blessings you've received. And so in the Bible, you know, Psalm 128:6, the good life is to get old enough to see your children's children. Yet this guy, the picture is, this guy lives incredibly long and has a ton of family. Like, he lives twice as long as Methuselah. It's an exaggeration, like 2,000 years. And he has 100 children. How many grandchildren and on down the way? This guy is exploding the charts for abounding blessing. If anyone should be erupting in joy and gladness, it doesn't get better than this guy yet with all that. Like, in essence, he discovers the fountain of youth. With all that, a gripping statement, his soul is not satisfied with life's good things. let that sink in a second. You don't get better than this in the Bible. But his soul is not satisfied with all those good gifts. He's still miserable and empty. It's not that the gifts are taken away. He has them, like Thanksgiving dinner. You know, he has them, imagine. But in the midst of all that, he's not satisfied. The joy and contentment in these gifts is another further gift on top of them. And he doesn't have it. To satisfy the soul needs even more than all of that. The silhouette. Do you see what you're made for? That what we're made for is more than that. Well, to press this home a little bit more, about his dissatisfaction on the son, the preacher says something that, I mean, it seems very insensitive and uncaring, especially if you're a parent who's gone through such a tragedy. He says it would be better, given the state of this man's soul under the sun, it'd be better if he had been just a stillborn child who never had the opportunity to do all of that. And what he's thinking about here is that this child was spared having to live in a fallen world with all the difficulties that it entails, and the fact that we're all, in a way, lining up for our day to die. He or she didn't have to go through that. But take a step back. Because underneath this is actually a deep comfort. Because this stillborn child that didn't have this extraordinary life received something that this man never had. The child finds rest rather than he. What that man desired, he'd never got, even in his gifts. And the preacher says the child got and not he. And the preacher really envies the child. The sense is the child is deprived of everything, but really has the one thing the wealthy man really needs and doesn't have, and that is rest with God. The starkness of that gift set in relief. What a covenantal way of thinking. Samuel Rutherford writing to a lady who lost her child. I write my blessing to that sweet child whom you have borrowed from God. He is not a heritage to you, but a loan from God. Belongs to God. Rest. The ninth reason. You make money to satisfy appetites that will never be quenched. Verse 7 through 9, the preacher says, when it's all said and done, you work to eat. You might have trendier clothes, fancier car, cooler trips, but when it's all said and done, you're just hungry. And you know what? You can eat an awesome meal and you can be hungry in a few hours. It just doesn't end. But it's not just physical appetite, it's all our other appetites. We just can't get enough. We're like that squirrel on Ice Age. He's going after that acorn and just can't quite get it. During COVID, the production company closed down. They ran a little short movie where he gets it, and this guy responds, I've been waiting 20 years for that. Children get a toy, and it just doesn't last long. They want the next one. Adults, we're the same. Like, we don't grow out of that. More money, more sex, more power, more everything. The grass is always greener. Desire outpaces satisfaction under the sun. It just will. And so the counsel is, don't be controlled by your appetites. The wise person understands this. The fool doesn't. A poor person, content with his life, lives well. But underneath this, C.S. Lewis, if you find in your heart desires that this world can't satisfy, doesn't that mean you're made for another world? 9 reasons why money is not a good master and won't satisfy us. But if you give me just a few minutes, he doesn't leave us there. 5:18 through 20, value your ordinary life as a gift of God. If we can live in gift mindset. So that section, every verse has God. Derek Kidner says the most important term there is God. It's a God-centered perspective. He's not just counseling us to make the best of a bad situation. He's setting before us the good life, which has God front and center as the giver of everything. And he's really taking us back to the Garden of Eden and saying, like Adam and Eve, eat and drink and work and keep and walk with God and love each other, the simple pleasures of life in fellowship with God. And behind this backdrop of the failed search for satisfaction under the sun, the preacher's lifting our view to above the sun and beyond the grave when he holds this all together as gift, and everything changes. All the gifts change when we hold this perspective in view, and it becomes right and fitting the few days of this life as we head to glory. Such that as we occupy ourselves with what God's entrusted to us and the people God's entrusted to us, viewing this as a gift from the one who is above, it all becomes significant and we find satisfaction in it because we get to glorify God in it and do good to others through it. And verse 20 is so sweet. God just occupies us in the rhythm of what we're doing and fills our heart with joy such that we just don't remember. We don't remember. Sometimes that's a good thing. But it all points to an ultimate gift. We train our hearts towards the ultimate gift. Jesus Christ, God's answer to the frustration of life under the sun. The logic of heaven, if he gave us Christ with forgiveness and righteousness and adoption and glory, he's going to give us everything else to speed us along to be with him. Gift. And second, value God's sovereignty over your life. It's not just an abstract doctrine, it's present with you, 6:10 through 12. He says, look, everything has been named. So the question is, by whom has it been named? Well, then he says, by one stronger than he. Well, who's the one stronger than us? The stronger one is God himself. He named it all, meaning he exercised his authority over it and his sovereignty over it when he brought it into existence and when he traced out his plan and who he governs and shepherds you through life. It's not accidental or chance. It's purposeful. He named it. And we can grumble against his providence, but we're invited to trust and rest in him. It's kind of like Tommy Nelson's story about the Navy guy in the ship. If some of you recall that one. This Navy guy in a ship looks out and sees a light facing him. And so he flashes his lights, change your course. And the light flashes back, change your course. So he flashes again, I am an admiral. And the light flashes back, I am a bosun's mate. So the admiral gets angry. He flashes back, I am a destroyer. And the light flashes back, I am a lighthouse. And like that, we can think we're something. And we can argue with God and kick against God, but what he's saying is, I have already designed you the way you function best, and that is with me at your center. And I alone can satisfy you. And I'm the one that can satisfy the big questions in life in verse 12. Because the big questions in life that come up are, who knows what is good for man during the few short days of his life? And God's saying, I knew, I know. I really know what's best for you. You need to know me. Well, who can tell us what will happen after this life under the sun? The preacher asks. And God's saying, well, I can. I ordained it all. And you know what that also means? Is that we are safe and secure throughout our life under the sun. And he will satisfy us one day perfectly. He sovereignly ordained Adam's fall into sin, thus unleashing frustration now. But even more, he sovereignly ordained our redemption by his beloved Son, our Lord Jesus Christ. For God himself came down from above into our fallen, miserable world to undo our curse and to resurrect in glory in order to open up a whole new world for us. And we're just preparing now for that and getting glimpses of that satisfaction now, whetting our appetite for our ultimate satisfaction in glory. And you get to enter that by faith alone, as a gift. And we get to live now in light of that, which invests all kind of significance in your ordinary little life today. May God add his blessing to you and the power to enjoy your gifts. Amen. Let's stand.